Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're going to learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's going to be a great day.
I know you're going to dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 142. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, buddy?
I'm working out. It's the new year. We're almost the end of January, and I'm still lifting weights. I'm gonna get skinny this year. I'm going to get thin.
This is the year? You're getting thin this year.
This is the year where I'm getting thin.
John's valiant attempt at segueing into the topic of the day, which is, yes, space efficiency. Well done, John. Yeah, so, man, last year we had some really, really good series. We had Fire, Flood, and Blood series, which has been really entertaining. You know, it's been this cautionary tale, if you will, of things from wise and experienced administrators, which are real fun. Those are good conversations. We've also had the Back to Basics series, which covers some core essentials that you should be knowing as an administrator. But this new series that we're going to start today called vSAN Deconstructed, I think it's going to be probably one of my favorite. In this new series, vSAN Deconstructed, we're going to take deep dives into small areas within vSAN. So this is going to be really fun because there are so many different areas inside of vSAN. And the beauty of vSAN is it's, you know, I like to say that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And I think that speaks volumes for vSAN because, yes, while under the covers, vSAN is very sophisticated, it definitely does a lot of the work for you. But this is going to be fun because we have a lot of vSAN experts inside of VMware that know a lot about all the really interesting details about vSAN. And so what we're going to do is every time we do this series, we're going to invite a panel of vSAN experts to share their deep knowledge in a particular area. And so this week, we're going to be talking about space efficiency, and we're going to invite some vSAN specialists to talk about that. And so with that, let's bring on our experts, starting with my good friend, Mr. Glenn Sizemore. Glenn, welcome to the podcast.
I have found all those pounds that Don Nicholson has put down. So don't worry, folks. I found them.
Yeah. And joining us as well is Mr. Pete Keeler. Pete, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, Pete. How are you?
Doing well, man. Doing well. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me. So, yeah, I think this is an area that we really needed to start doing. We needed to start breaking and diving a little deeper on very specific issues. And so, yeah, topic of the day, vSAN space efficiency. You know, and that in itself can be, you know, various subcategories. I want to spend a little time talking about deduplication and compression. I want to talk a little bit about erasure coding. And then maybe we can, if John has enough time, you know, and he's working, he's trying to get thinner, maybe we can talk a little bit about trim unmap. John, what do you think?
Oh, trim unmap. You've played my trap card. I'm not going to shut up. I'm going to talk for the next hour straight.
That's why I saved that one for last.
I'm going to filibuster this podcast about trim unmap.
Well, yeah. Well, why don't we start by level setting what is deduplication and compression as it pertains to VMware? Pete Keeler, why don't you tell us what it looks like in vSAN?
Well, first, Pete, I think we need to understand why we have space efficiency features in the first place. When we think about the overall goal of what a storage system is, it's really to be able to retrieve the data that has been saved there. That's the number one goal. Now, when we look at techniques in how we make this data more space efficient, those are really trying to address this scenario in which you want to make it much more cost efficient. So we have various techniques out there in the industry. vSAN uses a number of different techniques, all in an attempt to drive down the cost for that storage. So of course, deduplication and compression being one of them, and we'll mention a few others here on the podcast.
All right, well, let's start with the fact, you know, vSAN, deduplication and compression, while very different things, it's enabled and disabled at the same time, right?
Yeah, so for vSAN's implementation of deduplication and compression, that is a cluster-based feature or a cluster-based service. So once you enable that, that is going to be occurring on all data that is going to be written within the hosts that make up that vSAN cluster. And it's going to go through a process for us. It's really, it runs through several phases. But as the incoming writes come into the write buffer, that data is going to land in the write buffer and it's going to be acknowledged and sent back to the VM as it normally would. at the time that it's going to be destaged to the capacity tier, that's when we run through the deduplication and compression process. And that's going to look at what blocks are duplicated, and we'll be able to make metadata pointers or references to that very same block so that it doesn't have to write that block any more than it needs to. Then we follow that up with being able to compress the data based off of certain criteria that we've already defined.
Okay. So this is happening in memory, but does this slow down the actual writes to the data? Does the acknowledgments get put on pause, or can we do this after the writes have been acknowledged?
So that's one of the things that VMware chose, you know, from a design standpoint. When we implemented this process, we decided to approach this in a way where we wouldn't affect the latency on the writes as seen by the VM. So as those writes are coming into the write buffer, they're acknowledged, they're sent back. We want to always make sure that that is as fast as possible. That's why we choose the deduplication and compression process as it's being destaged. Now, there are other ways of doing this. Some solutions may do much more of a post-processing mechanism where they go through and they run through this process. But that has its trade-offs, just as all of these different methods have their respective trade-offs. Here, we wanted to ensure that we could maintain the performance of the VM as seen by the VM, but then be able to gain some of these space efficiency features or capabilities with deduplication and compression.
Yeah, I find that it's vSAN strikes a real fine balance here in coming in and including those efficiencies whilst still not completely front-ending. Because look, the reality is, you know, that first write, right? We're not doing any storage efficiencies. When the VM does that first write into the cache, into the buffer, as Keeler was explaining, that is purely just, let's just get the data protected, get it down on disk, act back to the client, get the workload going. And then the hypervisor, vSAN, is then opportunistically taking that data and moving it down to that permanent capacity tier. And by separating those two actions, right, for most customers, this leads to a scenario where you get all the benefit of those storage efficiency technologies without having to pay the amount of CPU and memory that it takes to do those actions all the time fast enough that you don't incur any performance delta on the IO initially. So it's very much a compromise, right, between a bunch of different architectures when you take a look at how vSAN's done this. But it's a compromise that avoids the downsides and finds a way to get the storage efficiencies in a shared nothing platform without either just completely inflating the amount of resources that we're consuming on the storage side of that HCI platform, or conversely, just completely breaking the efficiencies and consumption side.
All right. So question, you know, there's a big conversation around deduplication in general. Like, what is the level that we're deduplicating, you know? And it's, to my understanding, right, vSAN deduplicates at the disk group level. So what was the thought process around that? You know, you hear some people having global deduplication versus, say, deduplication at the disk group. What's the thought process around that?
I can speak to this a bit. One thing to think about is when you start doing global deduplication, which means basically you can do a match from any node to any node, is you now have to have a global metadata table. And to do this in a distributed system, you basically have to be able, we want to be able to do that in a high-speed way. So you often end up doing something like running an in-memory database or having a huge in-memory pool. Glenn's shaking his head here.
No, I'm completely agreeing with you, man. This is, it's look, I mean, look at these storage controllers. There's a reason they have half a terabyte of memory in them. It's because if you want to keep a petabyte of memory map to be able to do a dedupe map that big, well, you need the resources to do it. Do you want to contribute that much resources out of your HCI cluster?
Yeah,
I think you do.
And the challenge here is you basically have to have this a perfect golden ratio of memory to disk capacity. And the challenge is the price of memory and the price of SSDs used to trend kind of the same, but there's been cases where they have trended wildly different. And so array vendors are people who built systems like this. If you ever worked with ZFS back in the day, where it needed like 1 gigabyte of RAM per 100 gigs of capacity, when these ratios got kind of out of whack, dedupe basically became more expensive than it was worth. And so global dedupe, you basically are not only committing to a lot of overhead, but you're also committing to trying to predict the price of memory and disk, which is a game that I do not want to play. The other thing also is you're looking at an increasing fragility. With vSAN, we really like not having anything that becomes a that crosses our failure domains. And the issue therein lies is if we've got this global in-memory database that's keeping track of metadata, if you end up with some type of corruption, either from failures or just the nature of that system having its own bugs or other problems, you now have breached every failure domain you have. You've globally corrupted all data. Any type of corruption and those things, those get really nasty.
Yeah, there are definitely ways that other vendors can mitigate that, but you can start to see how it makes sense for vSAN to go down the path that it went down, at least given the architecture, how it works today. Since a disk group is our failure domain from a placement perspective, right? When DOM's trying to figure out where it's going to actually place that data, the disk group is the failure domain. So it makes sense to have that be the pool where we're actually going to go through and, well, I guess technically the host is the failure domain. But since that is where the fault can be, it makes sense to have that be the fingerprint where we're going to get the efficiencies. Because otherwise, as we said, you just end up eating too much resources. We could have done the other one, but your CPU would have been double and the memory would have been times six.
Yeah, and that's a great point there, Glenn, really in the sense that we had opportunities to tackle this problem in a number of different ways. And this just wasn't out of speculation. You know, we did a lot of internal testing during the early development of vSAN and made these very specific choices on how we were going to implement this. And this, of course, is one of them. We all know, but it's worth reminding the listeners again, scaling is really difficult. You introduce all kinds of challenges as you scale. One of the benefits about vSAN and how its architecture is that we want to maintain the complexity of the system and the durability of that system along with the space efficiency features that we are gaining here.
And the other thing, talking about global dedupe, there tends to be some limits on how large that pool can be whenever I've seen that implemented, either in primary or in backup products. There becomes a limit to how large will be supported. Given that, I mean, there are vSAN clusters. I've personally seen 2 petabytes in the wild looking at some of the phone home data. I think I've seen there's like some 4, and there's some crazy large clusters out there. I've often seen anytime someone talks about global dedupe, we're talking in terabytes, or maybe 100 terabytes. We're not talking petabytes that scale. And so just because either the cost or the supportability or the concerns about failure domains become too great. So trying to pretend global is unlimited, it's not. You need to ask that question from that global perspective. And again, a lot of that I think actually becomes not necessarily even the physics or the cost, but how big of a failure domain do we want to create? I at least have seen that from the backup vendors.
Yeah, I was going to refer to the fact that when we think about the costs of these activities, there's naturally going to be a cost that occurs. And from a technical cost standpoint, one of the things that can occur is that when you do enable deduplication and compression, that does effectively slow down the backing capacity tier. It requires more effort to place that data on the capacity tier as it's destaging. So when we have that two-tier architecture like vSAN, where we have a buffer and we have a capacity tier, our users have to be mindful of that from a design standpoint. And that's where we can run into scenarios if they have an environment where they have a large number of sustained writes occurring for a long time, then you have such a delta, such a performance delta between the buffer and the capacity tier that the buffer is no longer able to keep up.
Yeah. That's definitely the one thing to kind of be aware when we're talking about like the compromise that vSAN made. It solved a lot of challenges. Just for the sake of being thorough, right? We talked a lot about global. Let's just touch on post-process, something that's near and dear to my heart as a former ONTAP fanboy. I guess I'm still technically a fan.
The challenge with post-process is you have to have the capacity to handle the initial write, and it's impossible to know ahead of time how much data you're actually going to get back, right? So if vSAN had gone the post-process route, if you think about it, the way that it would end up manifesting is let's say you got that VDI thing, right? You run 100 VDI desktops, you need enough capacity to store all of them. And then at some point, your post-process is going to come through, find those duplicate blocks, and then clean up your file system and get rid of the duplicate data. It's relatively inefficient, and there's a reason that a lot of modern storage systems have moved away from this. vSAN avoids both of those extreme endpoints that we discussed. We don't have the scaling challenges. I mean, think about it, right? 64 nodes, five disk groups per node. That's 320 disk groups inside a single storage system. That is massive from a scale perspective.
Yep.
Not going to have 320 RAID groups in an aggregate. Get out of here. Like, it just doesn't work that way. So on the other side of the system, though, by having it do the deduplication and compression in between that buffer tier and the capacity tier, it's effectively in line without actually impacting the performance. So the customer gets the same experience from a consumption perspective of a true inline storage system, like All Flash VAS or Purity, something like that, right?
Yeah, you're not having to deal with that post-process defrag and also have the landing zone that I know some of the tier two backup players do. They have a big ass landing zone in that. We get the benefits of an inline without the headaches of the defrag.
Yeah, but it does create this one thing you got to be aware of, right? And that's that there's a performance difference between what we can drive through the buffer tier and what we can get through the capacity tier, because deduplication and compression are taking parallel write streams and serializing them because it has to, right? If we don't serialize the I/O, then how are we supposed to find two blocks from two different VMs that are actually the same?
Yeah, and one of the other interesting things that deduplication and compression can do, depending on the implementation, is that there's a natural cost between a first write and a second write, or an update on any sort of write. For deduplication and compression, depending on the implementation, that can actually reverse the cost, in which you have the second write, which is usually easier, that ends up being more costly.
So are there different types of workloads that are more preferable for deduplication, do you think? Or is it just, do you think it's a recommendation that everybody should use deduplication and compression?
Let me go ahead and leave it this, because we don't give you the option in the VMware Cloud and AWS service.
Oh, yeah.
It is on by default. And that's because, look, we're buying, or renting rather, because you don't own them. Even when we stand up an SDDC on the customer's behalf, we're still just renting these resources from AWS, right? We're renting a very expensive high-end resource, and we don't want to just be wasteful with it. We need to maximize our utilization. And when it comes to that world, yes, it is absolutely preferable that we save capacity and bias the service and capabilities towards storage efficiency. Now, on-premises customers who have a little bit more flexibility in their hardware selection have a little bit more control about controlling the cost of that hardware. And they may choose to just simply design around or go with a different kind of HCI implementation, ready node, VCF deployment type deal. It doesn't encounter the same type of capital constraints that force us to just take a hard line and say, no, turn it on. It's not worth turning it off ever. Whereas on premises, maybe you do look at it and say, no, we don't actually need the storage efficiency. I'd rather have the performance.
And with that, I think it's also important to note that whatever the decision is that the customer makes in those cases, one, that's a decision on a per cluster basis. They can have multiple vSAN clusters. One is running deduplication and compression. The others may not. But we also want to be mindful of the fact that newer versions of vSAN function better and are faster. And in the most recent case, vSAN 6.7 Update 3, we made specific improvements that improve the performance for clusters running a deduplication and compression. And those improvements were really significant.
Yeah, there are a lot of different improvements in 6.7U3. And we can touch on some of those, but there's a lot of them that I think we need to have a whole separate deep dive on just some of those performance enhancements, specifically as it pertains to like background operations, adding multiple threads, things like that. I think there's a lot of great content there. But what are some of the 6.7U3 enhancements to deduplication and compression specifically?
So we've done a number of things in 6.7 Update 3 to focus on improving the performance of deduplication and compression enabled clusters only. As I mentioned earlier here, when you're enabling deduplication and compression, that extra cost, that extra effort that it takes to run those processes, in a sense, slow down or reduce the performance levels that the capacity tier would be able to provide. So we've made some adjustments in the elevator algorithms that during the destaging process, we are able to destage much more aggressively earlier in the process, and therefore adjust our own internal signals, known as congestion signals, within the stack so that then we can regulate the level of latency that the VM is actually going to see. So the end result is that in these very high stress environments where they're being utilized or heavily utilized, we're able to deliver a much better level of consistency for those VMs in that environment.
Yeah, we used to see this often with heavy hitters inside the service, right? Where sometimes we'd observe a roller coaster effect with performance, right? Where the perf would go like a rocket ship for a little while, and then it would just flip over and latency would go up and perf would go down, and then it would get caught back up and it'd go off like a rocket ship, right? And just kind of go in these waves. And what this improvement did is it lowered that top point. So it doesn't go quite as hard. It's not quite as much of a rocket ship initially, but it removes that deep trough, right, or the decrease in the latency spike.
Right.
And really the thing that I would take with this is, for as advanced and sophisticated and as polished as vSAN really is, it's still actually kind of new. It's still pretty young. And the code is only getting better. It's only getting more polished. And when you take a look at what we've managed to do to this point, doing something that everyone else has just decided was too hard, right? Shared nothing, distributed storage with storage efficiency, HCI, get out of here. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
You got to have distributed HCI. Let's redefine the category, because that's the only way we can make this shit work, right? The we have taken a completely different path with this in trying to build a distributed system that doesn't ask the customer to compromise, that makes it just so easy to manage storage that you don't even need to have an additional team to do so. Your existing infrastructure team can just do it along with everything else. And when you take a look at where we're at with 6.7 U3, and as we like to do, look around the corner at where we're headed, like it's very clear that we will get to the top of this mountain. And when that happens, you know, 64 node shared nothing scale out combines, it's a completely different beast. Nobody has anything like it.
I like it. All right, let's transition over to erasure coding. You know, there are different ways to configure your vSAN virtual machines. Obviously, I think the default is RAID 1. Everybody's familiar with just doing a typical mirror. But then it gets a little trickier depending on how many hosts you have in your cluster. You have options to do RAID 5, RAID 6 erasure coding. So, and of course, depending on who you are, erasure coding may mean something different. But Pete, why don't you start us off? Like, what is erasure coding as it pertains to vSAN?
So erasure coding is really outlining our method of data placement with levels of resilience built in. We are able to spread a single object of block data across multiple locations with the parity built in to that object. So that's where we're, and we offer, you know, a number of different versions of that. We can do a RAID 5 erasure code, which has this implied level of failure to tolerate of 1, and then a RAID 6 erasure code, which has an implied level of failure to tolerate of 2. And unlike the space efficiency features such as deduplication and compression, this is, of course, on a per VM or per VMDK basis. The key to this is that unlike the opportunistic space efficiency features like deduplication and compression, where you're never quite sure what you're going to get, it's based off of a number of different variables, we know exactly what you're going to get as a result of space efficiency improvements with both RAID 5 and RAID 6. So those are some of the benefits there. Now, just as with any space efficiency feature, there's always those respective costs or the trade-offs that you have there.
So yeah, I mean, if we're thinking space efficiency, right? If I have a one VM that's, you know, 100 gigabytes, it makes sense with a RAID 5, that's only going to cost me 133 gigabytes to have that disk protected. Whereas if I had a RAID 1, it's going to be double, right? 200 gigabytes. So it makes sense to just always go with the less disks, right? Doesn't that, space efficiency is king, right?
Well, it all depends on what your priorities are. Really, honestly, we've had so many of our customers say that based off of a given workload that may not be used very much, but it's a large amount of capacity, then that is their priority. But then they have other workloads that where performance is their high priority. And the good news is that because of storage policy-based management, we can give you that choice. One of the questions that comes up quite a bit, though, and I think John and I have both fielded this question in one of our VMworld sessions was, you know, why did we choose to have the placement strategy for these erasure codes only live on a certain number of hosts? You know, a single object with the parity built in, it may only be on 4 hosts or 6 hosts. And the key there is really helping us understand from a durability standpoint and an ease of use standpoint, we want to make sure that vSAN as a cluster-based storage solution is as flexible as possible. If we were to take a different placement strategy where we were really spreading that data all the way across, then you run into some unique challenges with regards to durability. So that's one of the reasons why the implementation of our version of erasure coding for vSAN is the way that it is.
We also just solve that challenge directly with Stripe With, right? So if you need to actually get a resource to touch more hardware, we have an explicit way of telling the placement engine to deal with that, regardless of whether we're using RAID 1, RAID 5, or RAID 6. So it can be hard if you're an old school storage guy, you see RAID 5 and you think, I know RAID 5, so this is my RAID thing. No, it's actually RAIN. It's distributed across the network. It's not a local array of disks, right? We use these terms because people know what they mean and it's easy to map it, do the mental math. But really, vSAN is way more complicated than anyone actually thinks it is. And the average B is just way better served just letting the system deal with it, because you're not as smart as that algorithm. You're just not.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. So I'm a customer and I'm trying to decide if I want to go with RAID 1, RAID 5, RAID 6, et cetera. What are some of the things I should take into consideration when making this decision?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the customer should really understand that there is a trade-off on performance versus space efficiency when making those choices. RAID
5 or our implementation of RAID 5 erasure coding has an I/O amplification in order to provide that level of resilience. And so for every write that the guest is committing, you're going to see 4 additional IOs on the back end in order to make that happen. RAID 6, for every single write, you would see 6 additional IOs that would occur in order to make that happen. So naturally, that's going to change or shift some of the burden on the infrastructure, primarily your network and all of the, you know, the fabric that you're using to connect all of those vSAN hosts.
It's erasure coding is an interesting one because it really is a case where it depends. At a high level, I agree that this is a relatively straightforward and simple equation. Would you like to bias the workload towards being performant or space efficient? And that's really what vSAN does. It gives you a very simple to understand trade-off. If you want performance, use RAID 1 mirroring. If you'd like space efficiency, use erasure coding. And then 5 or 6, that's just controlling your failure to tolerate level. But what's interesting, and we see this inside VMC sometimes, it's not always that like RAID 1 will get better performance. Because for example, if you have a massive write workload where all you do is write all day long, big blocks, it never ceases, it never ends, RAID 6 is actually way more efficient at that, because at the end of the day, it has to write less data to the disk because the erasure coding algorithm is protecting that data, not with a second copy of it, but with redundant parity copies. And at a certain point, it actually becomes more efficient. And this really gets to my answer to all of this. It doesn't matter. And that's the point of SPBM. You try one. If it doesn't work, you try the other one.
Yeah, I agree with that. Beautiful. All right, let's transition to John's favorite topic. John, tell us about Trim Unmap.
So Trim Unmap is an interesting feature that has a long history. This dates back, you know, for those of you who remember 5.0, it was actually a bit problematic. There were some, you know, introductions or attempts to introduce it. This was, if you may have remembered, a CLI flag to go try to reclaim some space on a data store. We have come a long way since the dark ages. And encourage anyone who wants an hour of this conversation to go find Jason Massey and I, who did a VMworld deep dive just on this topic alone. The concept here is thin provisioning. So you start with thin provisioning. And let's say you provision a 100 gigabyte VMDK and you only put 30 gigabytes of data on it. Cool. So you're going to save 70 gigabytes. Awesome. you've basically gotten like a 3-to-1 space efficiency ratio just by doing nothing other than, you know, provisioning air. And this is actually something to be aware of because there's historically been some storage people in the industry who are like, look at our 50x space efficiency, and they're counting unmap, or not unmap, but they're counting thin provisioning just itself,
yeah,
which is like bragging about how much air is in the bag of Cheetos.
Technically, that air is protecting the Cheetos in transit.
Okay, fine. Anyways, I do love my Cheetos, which is probably why I need to keep lifting this weight as we talk. But no, so thin provisioning is awesome. And in fact, I don't think no one really makes enough hay about it, because it's often viewed as, well, everybody has thin provisioning, you know, so forth. So with vSAN, the backend is sparse. So by doing a thin VMDK setting any reservation, you're really just reserving capacity or adding air to a Cheetos bag and hard reserving that. But the challenge with thin provisioning comes from file systems. File system engineers are evil. And what they have always tried to do is optimize performance. And one way that they could optimize performance was never go bother to update any given block set and just always write into the air, always write into the empty bag. And so if I have a 30 gigabyte database sitting on a 100 gigabyte NTFS volume, and I keep writing to that database, I'm going to see my VMDK use a lot more than 30 gigabytes. In fact, I could have a 5 megabyte log file that just writes in a circle all day, and it will eventually, over enough time, degrade that thin provisioning and just use the whole VMDK. And people are like, what the hell? Where'd my thin provisioning go? And so people actually started saying, well, I'm not going to use thin provisioning in my maths for my sizing. I'm not going to count on it. It's unreliable. And this is because these file systems, they are not thin friendly. And this is a term that I've invented and passed through some great storage elders with beards, is called thin provisioning rot. Basically, it rots slowly. The thin provisioning corrupts, it rots away. So how do we get the space back? You know, how do we, it's tax season. How are we getting our space back, America? We're going to get we're going to reclaim. We're going to get a refund on our space. So how we do this is we need to signal to the underlying storage layer that, hey, this block's no longer unused. And within the ATA command set, there actually was a way for this, because this was used on SSDs back in the day, although not so much anymore, called trim. And this would signal to SSDs actually to enhance garbage collection and help with over-provisioning and not burning out NAND is where that command came in. On the SCSI side, this command set existed. This was called unmap. And what VMware does is, if you send a trim unmap in the OS and then the vSCSI layer, that gets translated over, we know what to do with that. So if you send this through, and this is enabled with vSAN, you have to enable this at the cluster level. I've got a whole guide. If you look for the space efficiencies guide on Storage Hub, it documents this. This will enable you to basically shrink VMDKs.
So John, this seems like it should have been this way all the time, right? At a very simple level, you think of, you know, if I delete a file, it should be gone and I should reclaim my space automatically. But that seems to be oversimplifying it. This seems like, so does it matter like what operating system I'm using, or is this, now that we have trim unmap working inside of vSAN, it's just perfect across all operating systems?
So we're going to need OS and file system support. You're also going to need to have it configured to either run systematically, like on a schedule, or automatically. And depending on your operating system, it should actually be different. So one thing to note is this wasn't introduced in the Windows ecosystem on the server side until 2012 family. And it's actually hidden under, it's called disk optimization is what the old defrag tool is. That's how you can run it as a one-time pass. For your CLI nerds out there, defrag/large L, I believe is the flag, will run that. And so actually, if you go to defrag a volume now, the default, it's actually just optimized. It'll go fire those off. The other thing is Windows by default is actually automatically sending those on delete now with modern Windows server and file nice. System. And so as soon as you delete something, it just goes through. Now, if you turn it on after the fact, go ahead and do a manual pass to purge that out. But by default, if it was on at the creation, it'll be doing it. The other challenge is Linux. So the Linux stack, this was done, if you wanted to do it automatically, it was done when you mounted a volume, you would use discard, the discard flag, which was, I believe, an O, lowercase o, on that mount. The challenge is Linux did a terrible job of optimizing this, and it was really thrashy on the back end. And so I would not recommend that. Instead, I would recommend you schedule FS trim. And there's an FS trim timer in some distros. You could do it as a cron job. DigitalOcean has a great blog that I linked to for my space efficiencies guide that actually talks about all the different OS families and what to do there. Obviously, there's some file system stuff specific to this. Don't ask me about ZFS. I think it's a weird cult, and I expect lots of Twitter hate for saying that again, but I'll say that. But no, actually ZFS on Linux just recently, I think, implemented it. But this is something that, yeah, you actually have some weird OS specific. You will have to make sure that if you're not using Windows, you will have to go do some configuration specific to Linux. And also, once you turn this on, you will need to reboot your virtual machine. So that way, the vSCSI controller will pass through it. The OS needs to know it's then. And so there's actually, I've got a video, if you go look in the Storage Minute series on YouTube, on vSAN trim unmap. And I actually show what that looks like and how that thin provisioning gets detected through.
And so what version of vSAN did we start getting trim unmap in the first place?
We got the trim unmap support in 6.7U1. Although, okay. Honestly, if you're that, you know, if you're upgrading, just go to U3.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. It seems like, man, the space efficiency conversation in general, it's definitely, you know, version specific. vSAN is a software product, and, you know, it's been getting better and better, not only with introducing new features, but making the existing features just more efficient, you know, faster and just more intelligent. It seems to be the recurring theme, in my opinion, as it pertains to vSAN.
Yeah, most certainly. I think, you know, and what you're seeing here in terms of space efficiency, and you really brought up that the good question just a few moments ago of why doesn't this happen, or why doesn't something like a trim unmap happen automatically and it's just there? Much of that comes as being an artifact from the fact that these operating systems had no assumptions about what they were running on. They just assumed they were running on bare metal, and they weren't going to be accommodating for those kinds of needs that occur in a shared storage environment.
Right.
So that's where some of these things come up. But the power of and really the position that VMware is in to be able to manipulate and control the hypervisor in such a way where we can work around these challenges that the guest operating systems haven't really worked around. And we can provide solutions so that then ultimately you can drive down those costs by improving that space efficiency while ensuring the durability of that data, because none of this matters if you can't retrieve the data.
Well said, Pete. Well said. All right, man. Look, I think we're at a good stopping point. You know, we've definitely dove slightly deep on deduplication and compression, erasure coding, and trim unmap. Plenty of more information on storagehub.vmware.com. I'll be sure to leave links on the show notes of this page. This is the first of many in this series of vSAN deconstructed. I think this is going to be good. Like I said, the panel's going to be slightly different every time. We got a pretty deep bench when it comes to vSAN experts inside this company. So I'm looking forward to getting all the different people on that are in this group and switching up the panel. Pete, Glenn, I really want to thank you guys for joining us this week.
Yeah, man, I really enjoyed this. I think it was fun to deep dive and take one of those internal calls that we normally have when we hang up the team meeting and just hit record and bring it out there for the rest of the world. We need to do this more often, Pete.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That will happen. All right, cool. John, anything else before we let these guys go?
No, that's good for now.
Good deal. All right, guys, thanks so much.
Thanks, Pete.
All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Glenn and Pete for deconstructing vSAN. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.